The headlines. Iran marks the 33rd anniversary of a deadly U.S. strike on an Iranian passenger plane. President Rouhani calls on Washington to apologize for the crime. The U.S. cybersecurity firm says at least 200 IT management companies in the U.S. have come under a massive cyber attack. Also coming up, Russia reports record COVID deaths for the fifth straight day, registering nearly 700 fatalities, as well as the highest daily caseload since early January. Well, welcome to our studio in the capital, Tehran. This is News. Thanks for joining us. Iran has called on the U.S. to apologize for the downing of its airliner over the Persian Gulf 33 years ago. President Hassan Rouhani says the U.S. has failed to make a formal apology for what he calls a heinous crime. Rouhani says the U.S. must explain why it awarded the captain of USS Vincennes, a cruiser that shot down the Iranian passenger plane on July 3, 1988. He says the move to reward the captain was in no way acceptable.
The U.S. brought on one of the deadliest disasters in aviation history 33 years ago on July the 3rd by shooting down an Iranian passenger plane. Iraner Flight 655 was en route from Tehran to Dubai. It was on its usual path when it was shot down by the U.S. Navy's guided missile cruiser USS Vincennes, killing all 290 passengers and crew members on board. 66 children were also among the victims. The then-U.S. administration claimed that the crew of USS Vincennes had identified the Iranian Airbus A300 as an attacking F-14 Tomcat fighter. Vincennes was traversing the Strait of Hormuz inside Iranian territorial waters, and at the time of the attack, Iraner Flight 655 was within Iranian airspace. Tehran declared the incident an international crime. It said even if the warship crew had mistaken the Airbus for an F-14, the tragedy was the result of the U.S. Navy's negligence and reckless behavior. Iran took its case to the International Court of Justice, but the case was settled out of the court in 1996 when the U.S. agreed to pay compensation. Washington maintained that the compensation was not a legal duty and was only based on an ex gratia. Although U.S. officials claimed the attack was a mistake, they never apologized to the Iranian nation and even awarded USS Vincennes commander Captain William Rogers. He was awarded the Legion of Merit decoration for what was described as exceptionally meritorious conduct in the performance of outstanding as a commanding officer of the Vincennes. The citation made no mention of killing innocent civilians on Iraner 655. When the matter was taken to the United Nations Security Council in July 1988, then the U.S. Vice President George H.W. Bush defended the Vincennes crew's action. He said, given the situation, the officers in question had acted appropriately. Bush noted, "I will never apologize for the United States. I don't care what the facts are." Succeeding American officials took the same approach. Over three decades on, still no justice for the victims of the one of the deadliest incidents in aviation history.
History professor David Yapobian says the fact that the U.S. refusal to apologize for its 1988 downing of an Iranian airliner shows that it regards itself as above the law.
This is the product of an imperial mindset and the mindset of American exceptionalism, that the United States somehow stands above international law and norms, that the United States does not need to heed the rulings of multilateral institutions, international bodies such as the United Nations, such as the International Criminal Court. And indeed, since the early 1990s, you know, over the last three decades, we have seen the United States essentially triple down on this position, even threatening members of the ICC and the ICJ for pursuing cases against, alternatively, the United States or apartheid Israel. So this is how the U.S. government views these multilateral institutions and views its past actions relative to the rulings of such institutions. And this is enabled by global American hegemony and the American empire. And so I'm saying this mindset, these sorts of statements and I guess most relevant, the inability for the world community to achieve justice in regards to the crimes of the United States.
Diplomatic efforts to save the Iran nuclear deal have intensified over the past months, but several rounds of talk in the Austrian capital have failed to bridge all the differences. In the following report, we will take a look at what's making the negotiations tougher than expected.
Iran and the remaining parties to the 2015 nuclear deal have held six rounds of talks in Vienna over the past months on a possible return of the United States to the agreement. Negotiators have said progress has been made at the talks, but a deal aimed at reviving the Joint Comprehensive Plan of Action remains elusive. The talks have been very tough. What's probably making the negotiations more difficult is the lack of trust caused by America's unilateral withdrawal from the deal in May 2018. By pulling America out of the agreement and reimposing sanctions, former U.S. President Donald Trump violated UN Resolution 2231 and defied international calls to remain in the deal. Trump was heavily pushed by anti-Iran lobbies in Washington, like that of Israel, to scrap the deal. But his withdrawal deeply undermined what was left of the U.S. credibility on the world stage. How can the world believe that the U.S. is serious about returning to the JCPOA and fulfilling its obligations after what Trump did? Iran's permanent ambassador to the United Nations, Majid Takhtravanchi, said this week that the U.S. needs to provide a guarantee that it will never unilaterally leave the JCPOA again if it wants to return to the deal.
This was a multilateral, not a bilateral agreement, so the Iranians are absolutely perfectly right to demand some kind of guarantee from the Americans that they will never pull out of the JCPOA again once it's agreed, or if it's agreed, or if it's resurrected, regardless of which administration comes into power.
Observers believe Iran's demands sound very logical in the light of past experience, because ensuring that JCPOA parties will not unilaterally leave it in the future seems an absolutely necessary step at this point.
Iran's UN envoy says America's pullout from the JCPOA was wrong, outrageous, and against international law. Takhtravanchi said that he told the Security Council this week of the damaging impact of U.S. sanctions on Iran's economy and people's lives. Iran insists that the U.S. sanctions must be removed now before any revival of the nuclear deal.
Diplomatic efforts are still underway between Iran and the remaining parties to the deal. U.S. negotiators have been talking to the Europeans, as Iranians have ruled out talks with them. The JCPOA revival talks seem to be much more complicated than first thought. Meanwhile, U.S. President Joe Biden, who had pledged a shift in policy, is fully enforcing his predecessor's favorite sanctions against Iran. This week, outgoing Iranian President Hassan Rouhani warned that his U.S. counterpart's failure to begin to implement the JCPOA is a betrayal of the votes of the American people. Many in Iran believe Joe Biden has failed to even show any meaningful goodwill gesture.
Well, the first thing he needed to do, but did not, was come to the table in Vienna with a fulsome apology to Iran and to the Iranian people who have suffered grievously as a consequence of these sanctions that have been leveled under the rubric of maximum pressure. The Iranian people have suffered inordinately as a consequence, lacking vital medicines, in the midst of a pandemic. The sanctions were still maintained and upheld when they were almost begging for them to be lifted so that they could succor the Iranian people in the midst of COVID. So the Biden administration should have come into the renewed talks in Vienna in a spirit of contrition, but instead it's the same old imperial arrogance.
A few days ago, United Nations Secretary General Antonio Guterres appealed to Biden's administration to lift or waive all sanctions on Iran. In a report to the UN Security Council, the UN chief also urged the United States to extend the waivers regarding the trade in oil with Iran. What's behind Biden's foot dragging? Iranians have repeatedly warned that the United States is not trustworthy, especially after its unilateral withdrawal from the nuclear deal. Biden's approach is definitely not serving to allay Iranian concerns. the fate of the JCPOA, which was once hailed as a great international diplomatic achievement, is unclear. The coming weeks and months will probably show whether the half-dead deal can be saved.
Palestinians in the Gaza Strip mark 15th anniversary of Israeli siege on the territory. The crippling siege has affected all aspects of life in the enclave, deteriorating the economy and depriving some 2 million people of freedom. Ruba Shevit has more from Gaza.
Over 1 month since a ceasefire came into force between the Israeli regime and Hamas, Palestinians in the Gaza Strip still suffer from psychological trauma and feel unsafe. While fears are rising of another round of violence, Palestinians mark 15 years of a land, air, and sea Israeli blockade that has devastated Gaza's economy and caused widespread destruction, leaving most people largely cut off from the outside world.
The Israeli blockade imposed for 15 years led Palestinians to call for simple solutions. This blockade, of course, affected all life aspects, especially the rate of poverty and unemployment. There are many graduates who are jobless now. Wars and Israeli blockade isolated Gaza from the world, and it's not surprising that many countries know nothing about Gaza.
Israeli blockade imposed on the Gaza Strip affected badly on all life aspects, leading to high rates of poverty and unemployment. Most of the working-age population in the Gaza Strip are unemployed and without any source of income due to the lack of job opportunities.
There are a lot of graduated people without a job in Gaza. The unemployment rate is high and there are no job opportunities. For 15 years, we have been living in the same situation. There has been continuous escalations and war over Gaza, and people will suffer from everything and nothing changes.
Due to the limited sources and restrictions imposed in movement and entry of goods and fuel, only a limited amount of fuel and cooking gas reach homes and the electricity plant. As a result, Gazans are suffering an electricity crisis that has devastated daily life, especially on clean water, as people in Gaza suffer from salty and polluted water that is not fit for drinking. Both the continuous violence over the Strip and the Israeli blockade affected badly on every aspect of life for Palestinians, isolating and depriving them from their rights. Ruba Shevit, Gaza.
At least 200 IT management companies in the U.S. have come under a massive cyber attack. Huntress Labs, a cybersecurity firm, says the ransomware targeted a software supplier called Kaseya in the state of Florida. The hack then spread through corporate networks using the software. Huntress Labs says that it believes Russia-based hackers are behind the breach. The U.S. Cybersecurity Agency has announced that it is taking action to deal with the situation. Ransomware attacks typically involve locking away data and systems using encryption, making companies pay to regain access. Back in December, federal agencies, including Treasury, State, Defense, Energy, and Commerce departments, were targeted by unknown hackers. Then Secretary of State Mike Pompeo blamed Russia, but Moscow rejected the accusation. More bodies have been recovered from the ruins of an apartment building that collapsed more than a week ago in the U.S. state of Florida.
Over the course of today's search, we did recover 2 additional victims. We now have 22 confirmed deaths, 188 people accounted for, and 126 unaccounted for.
The mayor also said that she has signed an emergency order to demolish the remains of the building to ensure the safety of the search and rescue operation. The worries about the stability of the still-standing part of the tower paused search efforts on Thursday amid rough weather conditions. The Champlain Towers South high-rise partially caved in on itself in the town of Surfside near Miami. The cause of the incident has not been determined yet. Initial attention has focused on structural deficiencies described in a 2018 engineer's report. Canadian authorities are set to deploy military aircraft to help evacuate towns in danger of wildfires fueled by an unprecedented heat wave in the country. Officials say the armed forces have already been positioned in different regions for logistical assistance. Prime Minister Justin Trudeau has also pledged support for the affected areas. The record-breaking temperature and wildfires have resulted in the forced evacuation of several cities in British Columbia in the past 2 days. Medical experts say the unrelenting heat has largely contributed to the growing number of sudden deaths in western provinces. More than 100 wildfires are burning through the region. Officials have warned about flooding from melting mountains in the west and new heat waves moving towards the central areas. Russia has reported record COVID deaths for the fifth straight day, registering 697 fatalities in the last 24 hours. Health authorities also confirmed nearly 24,500 new cases on Saturday. This is the highest daily caseload since early January. The capital Moscow and the port city of St. Petersburg remain epicenters of the new wave of infections, which authorities say is driven by more transmissible Delta strain. A lagging vaccination drive has also worsened the situation. Officials have already said that Russia no longer expects to meet its goal of vaccinating 60% of the population by the fall. Russia has so far confirmed more than 5.5 million coronavirus cases and over 137,000 deaths. However, some 12% of the population is fully vaccinated. Meanwhile, Australia's New South Wales state has recorded its biggest daily rise in COVID-19 infections this year. Sydney, the state capital, has been hit hardest in a flurry of outbreaks of the highly contagious Delta variant around the country over the past 2 weeks. New South Wales reported over 65 new cases in 2 days, taking the tally under the current outbreak to more than 250. State officials have warned that the next couple of days will be critical in terms of infections. This comes as Sydney is halfway through a two-week lockdown. Authorities say it is still too early to make a decision on whether to extend the lockdown. Nearly 20 people have been reported missing in Japan following landslides triggered by heavy rains in the central prefecture of Shizuoka. Rescue operations are underway in the city of Atami. Prime Minister Yoshihide Suga has also called for an emergency task force to tackle the crisis. Japanese media say the raging water has swept away homes and vehicles in Shizuoka. Weather services also warned about potential floods and continued heavy downpour in the upcoming days. Similar alerts were also issued in Kanagawa Prefecture. Last year, 50 people lost their lives in Japan following heavy floods and landslides that devastated the country's southwestern regions. That's all the time we have for this edition of World News. So bye-bye for now.
Fruitful Moment with IRIB English Radio.
Log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en.
Bismillahir Rahmanir Rahim.
Assalamu alaikum wa rahmatullah.
Selection of Ayatollah Khamenei's viewpoints.
همه با وجود قده سرطانی اسرائیل مخالفیم.
All of us are opposed to the cancerous tumor Israel.
وجه مشترک همه وحدت امت اسلامی.
Unity of Islamic Ummah is the aspect that all of Islamic denominations have in common.
Televised speech on the eve of the 13th presidential election, June 16, 2021. People's duty with regard to the elections, participation in the elections, and what kind of participation. In the Islamic Republic, Republic is one part and Islamic is another. If Republic is not a part of it, then the Islamic Republic will not be realized. On the other hand, there are many political aspects and the political effects are productive and full of blessings, some of which I will mention later on. This is exactly why all the satanic centers of power in the world, those who oppose and bear animosity towards the Islamic Republic, are particularly against and opposed to the elections. In all our elections over these decades, their media has always been used as a political means to destroy people's mindset toward the elections and to interfere in some way in the elections in order to prevent the splendor and glory of the Iranian elections from being shown. Over these many years, all the elections have been held on time, even if they cannot see this. They haven't been cancelled or postponed even one day. People have come to the ballot boxes and cast their votes. Of course, there has been hostile propaganda. This propaganda has always existed before and after the elections. Perhaps there is no other country in the world that can be found whose elections have been attacked by the enemies this much. For this election, which will take place on Friday, the day after tomorrow, the US media, the UK media, and their mercenaries who are working for these media have been working for several months now. They are working very hard in an attempt to try to throw doubt on the elections, downplay people's participation and make allegations against the elections of the Islamic Republic in some way. They say all different kinds of things in this respect. Well, their goal is for the elections to not to be held as desired by the Islamic Republic. What does this mean? It means that they want the people to distance themselves from the system. Because a lack of participation in the elections naturally means people distancing themselves from the Islamic Republic. This is the goal they pursue.
Alhamdulillah, Alhamdulillah, all praises to Allah, all praises to Allah.
Africa Today.
French President Emmanuel Macron says he recognizes that his country bears a heavy responsibility for the 1994 genocide in Rwanda, in which nearly a million people had lost their lives in a period of only 100 days. Now, during a recent visit to Kigali, Macron failed to meet the expectations of many who wanted him to apologize for the genocide. An activist working with Rwanda genocide survivors insists that France must apologize. Hello and a warm welcome to Africa Today. I'm your presenter, Mubarak Kenyam. Now, this week's edition is focusing on crimes by two major European powers in Africa. In the first segment of our program, we are analyzing the recent visit to Rwanda by President Macron of France, where he publicly acknowledged his country's terrible responsibility in Rwanda's genocide, but refused to apologize. In the second part of our program, we shall discuss the genocide perpetrated by Germany in Namibia over 100 years ago. Now, to compensate for its atrocities, the German government recently offered an apology and pledged 1.1 billion euros only in financial aid over a 30-year period. The descendants of the genocide victims have rejected the aid offer and are demanding full reparations.
We are living in poverty because of what they did to us at that time. Now we want them to restore our dignity. Reparations must come, and we want our land back.
Join us till the end of our show as our analysts delve deep into these two subjects.
Macron refuses to apologize over Rwanda genocide. Survivors of the 1994 Rwandan genocide say they're disappointed after French President Emmanuel Macron gave no clear apology over his country's role in the massacre of almost a million people in the African country. Speaking during a visit to Kigali last May, Macron claimed that France was not an accomplice in the Rwanda genocide and thus refused to offer an apology. The French president gave his speech at the Kigali Genocide Memorial Center at Gisozi, where some 250,000 victims of the 1994 genocide are buried.
Macron's visit follows the release in March of a report by a French inquiry panel that said a colonial attitude had blinded French officials and the government bore a serious and overwhelming responsibility for not foreseeing the genocide. However, the report absolved France of direct complicity in the killings. In April, Rwanda also released a report on France's role in the genocide against the Tutsi. For an incisive analysis on this subject, we have contacted Claude Gatebuke, a Rwandan war and genocide survivor, and the executive director of the African Great Lakes Action Network. Thank you for coming.
Thank you. Thank you for having me.
We also have with us here today Philip Rengens, an author and academic. He has acted as an expert witness on the law and politics of Rwanda, Burundi, and the DRC in national courts in several countries, and before the International Tribunal for Rwanda. Thank you for coming.
Thank you very much for having me. It's a pleasure.
Now, let's start with you, Gatebuke. Why has Macron accepted French responsibility in Rwanda genocide, but refused to offer an official apology?
Since the genocide, there has been accusations, including court cases in France, where the president of Rwanda, Paul Kagame, has been accused of shooting down the plane of his predecessor, President Juvenal Habyarimana. And the shooting of the plane sparked the genocide. So the French have gone back and forth with the Rwandan government with a love-hate relationship. My sense is that Emmanuel Macron does not actually believe in what he's saying, because if he actually did, he would offer an official apology. But I'm sure he wants to leave this hanging over the government of Rwanda, that when they would like to bring up this accusation again of the Rwandan president shooting down the plane in the Rwandan Patriotic Front, which is the party in power, being responsible for the crime that started the genocide, that sparked the genocide, that they could still reopen the case.
Thanks for that. Now, it's quite an interesting viewpoint. Edige Nkuranga, the president of Ibuka, an umbrella organization that connects group aiding survivors of the genocide, has condemned Macron, saying he did not present a clear apology for France's role in the 1994 genocide. Let's now bring in Professor Rengens. Why did Macron refrain from apologizing over France's involvement in the Rwanda genocide?
Well, it may well be that he felt, and he will probably have been advised on that, he might feel that if you offer apologies, a claim for reparations might follow. Remember, the German document apologized for the genocide of the Herero in current-day Namibia, and Germany is now paying pretty hefty reparations, so I suppose Macron didn't want to expose France to a demand for reparations.
Countless thousands of children were slaughtered during the Rwandan genocide that was enabled by France. Proof of the carnage is still visible throughout the country. Across the country, individual killers carried out their work with unfathomable cruelty. A survivor explains here how children were killed.
Yeah, it was full of children, died. They took the children, they drop on the wall, they put on the wall, like this. You see, these are the blood of children.
If France was to offer an apology to Rwandans over the genocide, what would be the implications?
An official apology, I think, would the implications would be that whoever is a responsible party in the genocide, including France and anybody else that would be shown to have had a role in the genocide, they would actually have to pay reparations. They or their officials would have to be taken to court and face charges of genocide. And so I think that's a part of the reason why President Macron is avoiding an official apology. Although I do think that the government of Rwanda itself, the president of Rwanda himself, should also respond to the charges against him about sparking the genocide, because the genocide was sparked by the shooting of the plane, and a lot of his own officers have testified to it, including courts in France.
Official documents, survivors' testimonies, historic reports, books, and investigations have made available a barrage of information on France's participation in the Rwanda genocide. Researchers, however, estimate the classified secret documents in the government's archives still hide the truth.
Rwanda has long accused France of complicity in the 1994 genocide, but during Macron's visit to Kigali, President Kagame evidently softened his hardline stance. This is what he had to say after listening to Macron's speech.
His words were something more valuable than an apology. They were the truth.
Well, our last question to you, Professor. Why has President Kagame changed his previous hardline stance on France?
Well, I think both leaders had good reasons to try and establish normal relationships again. As far as Kagame is concerned, he has been, to some extent, I wouldn't say abandoned, but his usual allies, particularly the British and the Americans, have become more and more critical about his politics, about the level of democracy, human rights abuse, etc. It's also, I think, important for France because they have been, in part because of the conflict with the Rwandan regime, they have been basically out of Central Africa, or at least out of the Great Lakes region, which is an important region for them because it's a border between Anglophone and Francophone Africa.
Thank you very much, Professor Rengens. Professor is an author and academic, and he's also an emeritus professor of law and politics at the Institute of Development Policy, University of Antwerp. Now, back to you, Claude. Why is President Kagame eager to mend Rwanda's ties with France at this point in time?
Kagame's approaching of France is also a political move, because what has happened is, traditionally, Kagame has been a, if I can use this word, a puppet of the West. He's been basically a servant of Western governments, the UK and the US being the primary sponsors of Paul Kagame. And in recent years, they've started to distance themselves from Kagame and his government. And because of that, he's looking for new friends. And France itself is losing its influence on the continent of Africa, and Rwanda being one of the former French-speaking countries where France used to have an influence, I think France is trying to recover some territory.
France has deployed thousands of troops in several African countries to ostensibly battle terrorism, but despite this military presence, terrorists and bandits continue to wreak havoc in these countries where French troops are present.
Now, as we wind up, I'm sure you recall that the French military operation during the Rwanda genocide was carried out under the guise of a humanitarian mission. Is history repeating itself in other French military missions in Africa that are being carried out to ostensibly battle terrorism?
You know, you look at so many places where they're involved in the Central African Republic, you know, how close they are with Cameroon and Chad and so many others, and you can tell their reason for being there, and in Libya and Mali and so many other places, their presence is problematic. Even in the Ivory Coast, their history there. it's been at a when the French go there, again, history repeating itself, they go there really to occupy, to take over, to take control of those countries, to install their puppet leaders, or to turn the leaders there, the current leaders, into puppets that they control, and then take control of resources. And they do not actually care about fighting terrorism or saving lives. They are there to serve the interests of France, which are purely economic interests and not interests of saving human lives or even fighting terrorism.
Well, you have it there. France is pursuing selfish economic interests in its renewed engagement with African countries. Thanks a lot for your analysis, Mr. Claude Gatabuke, a Rwandan war and genocide survivor and the executive director of the African Great Lakes Action Network. Now, let's take a short break, and when we come back, we shall discuss the rejection of Germany's genocide deal with Namibia. So don't go away.
Namibians reject Germany's genocide deal.
From 1904 to 1908, German colonizers waged a brutal campaign of genocide against the Herero and Nama people in present-day Namibia. It was estimated that 65,000 of the 80,000 Herero, that is around 80% of the Herero population, were killed during the genocide. Some 10,000 of an estimated 20,000 Nama were also brutally killed by German colonial forces.
More than a century ago, after these atrocities it committed, Germany has now issued a late apology and promised development aid to those affected. Foreign Minister Heiko Maas says that Germany for the first time recognizes that it had committed genocide in Namibia during its colonial period. Many Namibians have rejected the so-called development aid being offered by Germany as compensation for its colonial era genocide. A Namibian politician says Germany perpetrated the genocide and can therefore not purport to make a just and neutral decision on reparations.
Germany has been dictating. And for me, it was like a case of you have a murderer or a rapist, and this person is the one to decide whether I have raped or not, and should I find myself guilty, what could be the best punishment or verdict that I can give myself? So that is how the whole process was not acceptable to us.
Now, for an incisive analysis of this subject, we contacted Dr. Mugindo Kajiwa, Secretary General of the Oba Herero Traditional Authority. Thanks a lot for joining us today, Doctor. Now, can you first briefly elaborate to us on how the Nama and the Herero genocide took place in present-day Namibia during the German colonial rule?
The Nama and the Herero genocide is a genocide. The German government issued two extermination orders, written, translated in local language, distributed, and then they implemented their intention as planned or as intended and carried out to the letter. Rounded Hereros and Namas refugees or prisoners of war, put them into concentration camp, ensure that they are put to heavy labor and also hanged, make sure that the population is reduced. In fact, at the end of the genocide, General Lotha von Trotta stated that the Herero nation would never continue to exist as it was. He has completed his role, his job successfully.
Thank you for that, and we'll be back with more.
Germany agreed to pay Namibia 1.1 billion euros as it officially recognized the Herero-Nama genocide. Angela Merkel's government claims the payment amounts to a gesture of reconciliation, but not legally binding reparations. Herero and Nama leaders dismissed the deal as a public relations coup because it did not include funds deemed reparations. It has also been hugely disappointing to the Herero and Nama that the funds will be distributed over a period covering three decades.
The Herero chief, Bekui Rukoro, who died recently of COVID-19, was leading fierce opposition to the offer by Germany. He accused Germany of pursuing a racist policy by refusing to negotiate directly with those affected by the genocide.
And the only difference, Germany is continuing to refuse to sit down with us as victims of their genocide and extermination campaign is because we are black Africans. So it's a racist policy.
Now, Germany has offered a 1.1 billion euro settlement, which has been rejected by the Herero and Nama leaders. Why have they rejected this deal?
We cannot agree to a product within which we are excluded. And in any case, the amount of money that they have agreed to is a slap in the face, is an embarrassment for the Namibian state. It's not even the value of land, over 50 million hectares of land confiscated in Namibia equates that. The land alone that is taken by the colonizers, it's about 70, 75 billion euros. And that alone, the 100,000 lives that are lost, the displacement of people in the neighboring countries.
Descendants of the affected communities rejected the text of a joint declaration between the Namibian government and Germany, which omitted the word reparation. They also called for the renegotiation of the agreement with a focus on increasing the financial amount offered by Germany.
Now, what do you think should be done for justice to be served to the Herero and Nama people?
We have been consistent that we must revert back to the National Assembly resolution, which was unanimously adopted by the Namibian Parliament, which says the victim communities, the two governments must sit around the table, and the victim communities must be represented by their chosen leaders as victims of genocide. They must propose to negotiate a package that addresses the needs of the victims wherever they are. So the negotiations must start afresh. We will not accept what is on the table.
Now, as you continue the struggle for the rights of the Herero and Nama communities, what's your message to the international community?
We're calling upon the international communities, peace-loving people, people that are fighting for justice, restorative justice. We're calling on that community to support us in our struggle for restorative justice. We hope the national governments will put more pressure on Germany to recognize the genocide and pay reparations. We will continue this fight. We will bring it to the United Nations, to the governments of the world, to ensure that Germany is pressurized through political pressure and negotiations, that recognizes genocide and pays reparation that is due to the victims of genocide in Namibia.
Well, thank you very much. The Secretary General of the Herero Traditional Authority in Namibia. Now, here at Press TV, we shall continue updating you on the continued struggle for reparations by the oppressed Herero and Nama communities in Namibia. Well, that brings us to the end of yet another edition of Africa Today. It's been great having you, and please do send us your comments through our social media handle. Thanks a lot, and goodbye for now.
This is IRIB English Radio. Please log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en. This man changed the world.
Our bosses couldn't cope with the idea of an 80-year-old Ayatollah, which they didn't even know what an Ayatollah was, who lived on garlic and onions and yogurt, directing a revolution that was about to topple America's most important ally.
ملت ایران ملت معجزه آسای قرن است.
الله اکبر. خمینی رهبر. الله اکبر. خمینی رهبر. الله اکبر.
بسم الله الرحمن الرحیم. In the name of Allah, the exalted, the most compassionate, the most merciful. Salam, hello and welcome to our audience, and particularly a warm welcome to our listeners of our program, The Man Who Changed the World. This is a program dedicated to the memory of Imam Khomeini, may God bless his great soul, and it's about his life and times and the impact this man made on not only the Muslim world, but the entire globe as a whole. Once again, I'm your host on this program, Ijaz Hussain, and I'd like to bring in Dr. Mahdi Turabi, my good friend, on this subject, and I'd like to say salam to him and welcome him to the program.
Alaykum salam wa rahmatullah. Thanks, friend.
Thank you very much again. Dr. Mahdi Turabi, we spoke at length about, the impact that Imam Khomeini made, as you said, on a pretty materialistic, secular world in which religion was marginalized, and how Imam, by living Islam, made an enormous impact on reviving and putting religion back on the world map. But now we want to move on a bit more, because I remember, as you will as well, that Imam Khomeini, rahmatullahi, the first thing I remember about him was his call for unity. And he would say that it is perfectly permissible to go to Sunni mosques and pray behind a Sunni prayer imam and so on and so forth, so that we could foster fraternity, unity, in the spirit that our Holy Prophet, peace be upon him, used to do right at the beginning and the outset of Islam, to bring brotherhood and genuine friendship amongst each other, so that with this unity we would become powerful in this world. Your take on that, Dr. Mahdi Turabi?
Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. It's exactly as you said it, which is that, the only ones that benefit from us fighting, Sunni Shia fighting, are the enemies of Islam.
Exactly.
Well, it's
exactly.
as simple as that.
It's as simple
there's
as
really
that.
Not,
yeah.
You know, it's not really that complicated.
No, it's not.
You know, the things that we have differences on, well, you know, that's just the way it is.
Yeah.
But, you know, the majority of things we don't have differences on.
And the other thing was that we were
so
asked...
You focus
yeah.
on that.
You
and
focus
you talk
on
about
that, yes.
the other things,
yeah.
and you do it in a peaceful way, and you do it
sure.
as you would with your brother, in the sense that you love each other, and you know, take care of each other, and you help each other.
Yes.
And the difference is you try to work out with each other.
Well, the
so
other
the
other thing
you know?
Was, Dr. Maddie, I'm sorry to interrupt, but the other thing is that as far as what I remember, the message was that there was no need for a Shia to be a Sunni or a Sunni to be a Shia. The main thing was that we, you know, respect each other's beliefs, respect each other's points of view, but the main thing is that we are united in terms of our purpose in living Islam, you know, creating this Islamic civilization and, you know, presenting an alternative to the rest of the world that is sinking in social ills and, you know, and corruption and all kinds of deviance, which, you know, Islam purifies us from.
Exactly.
Yeah.
And look at our history. I mean,
yeah.
you know, the reason that, you know, they were able to come and take over the Muslim world is because we were divided. I mean, it's simple.
Yeah.
It's not that difficult.
No, it's not. It's not
okay.
rocket science, as they say.
It's not rocket science.
Yeah.
Okay. You, when we were divided, they were united. They took over.
Exactly.
Wassalam.
Okay. Wassalam. Yes, exactly.
Okay.
I can see that even now. Yeah, absolutely.
Okay.
Yeah.
And they're still doing it.
Yeah.
And the reason they like having Al Saud be the guardians of Mecca and Medina is because, and the Taksiris is because that's going
to
lead, you know,
to more division.
That helps them. Control of the Muslim world.
Exactly.
And if you get rid of Al Saud and the Taksiri, that's it.
You've absolutely.
Got, you know, I mean, how much better would that be for the Muslims, right?
Absolutely, absolutely. Because this is the main source of contention at the moment, the main root cause of...
And remember, the Taksiris are not Sunni.
No, they're not. No, no.
The Taksiris are neither Sunni nor Shia.
No,
they're
no.
Taksiris.
They're enemies. They're actually the...
They're the enemies.
They're hypocrites
the ones,
that the Quran speaks
the
about.
They're the ones that are doing the bidding of the Zionists in America.
Exactly. Exactly.
That's it.
Yeah.
Okay. Why are you so? You know, when are you going to get it?
Absolutely.
I almost said it. why are you going to get?
Because I mean, it's in the words of Netanyahu himself. He says Saudi is the last line of defense for this illegitimate state of Israel.
I'm just saying, you know, to all Muslims, Sunni, Shia. Young, old, you know, brothers
yeah.
and sisters.
Sure.
You know, it's so clear to everyone now what's going on.
Exactly.
You know, whatever, 30 years ago, whatever.
Mm.
Okay? Isn't it clear now who's with who, who gets money from who is, you know, giving money to cannibals and organ eaters and who is...
Yes, yes.
Yes,
Vladimir Putin who said, yes, I'm not going to support organ eaters. I don't want my kidney to be cooked by a takfiri.
You know,
yeah.
It's time to step up, and I'm
exactly.
talking, you know, mainly the Sunni brothers and sisters. You see the realities. Why are you still stuck? Why are you still worried about? What are you still? You know, why are you still confused?
Mm.
Why are you confused? Look at what happened to Ikhwan.
Yes.
They trusted. They went with the Saudis. They went with the Americans. They got burned. This is mainly, you know, addressed to the Sunni brothers.
Yes, absolutely.
Look at what has happened in the last year.
Yes. Particularly in Egypt, yes.
Egypt, Turkey, and all those places where the so-called, you know...
Brotherhood.
The mainstream, moderate, the proper, you know, Islamic movements, the minute they aligned themselves with the Saudis and with the Israelis and the Americans, they got burnt.
They got burnt,
They
yes.
got stabbed in the back.
Exactly. And Imam Khomeini... May God bless his soul, was warning against this kind of thing, wasn't he? He was telling them...
Why are you still having such problems with Shia?
Exactly.
What's your problem?
Yeah.
Who's been talking about unity since, you know, 40 years?
Yeah, exactly.
Who's been supporting, you know, Sunni resistance movements like Hamas?
Like Hamas in Palestine, yes, absolutely.
Right? Who is the one that's, you know, supporting, you know, getting support from Israel?
Exactly.
And getting support from America and getting support from the Saudis. The Saudis, you know, Morsi comes to power, Saudis give him a couple billion in order to buy him off.
Yes.
the minute he's overthrown, the first person congratulating, you know, the military in Egypt is Saudi Arabia.
Absolutely, absolutely. Yes, General Sisi got a pat on the back there. Yes, absolutely.
You want Al-Saud to be your leaders? Is that the kind of leaders you want? Forget about Sunni Shia.
Yeah.
Is that who you want to be your leader? Or do you want somebody who's been talking about unity, who's been acting it, living on it, for the last 34 years?
Exactly.
Who was able to become independent from their, you know, previous imperial master, who's, you know, everybody's educated, everybody's participating in the elections, everybody's, you know, has a future. And yes, there are difficulties, of course, there's sanctions, there's things that all so-called developing countries are going through, but where would you rather be today?
Yes.
Where is
That's
the
a
future?
Very good question. Very
where
good
is the
question.
Future today?
Yes.
Right?
Quite.
So now you have a generation of youth in the Muslim world who are either faced with becoming Takfiris or, you know, becoming westernized, you know, servants of America and Israel. That's it. These are the two options they're giving you.
My God, they're both ugly. No, you know, not a choice I'd like to make. Not a
right,
choice I'd
is,
like to make.
This is the way. And, you know, either way, you're abandoning your religion.
Of course you are.
Right?
Of course you are.
Either way, you're going against the precepts of your religion.
Exactly.
Against the Quran, against the Sunnah.
Yes, exactly.
If you become the servants of non-Muslims, you're going against it. If you become Takfiri and, you know, organ-eating cannibals,
yep.
you know,
yep.
you're going against your religion. So
sure.
they're basically saying to you, you got to give up your religion. So why do you have a problem with Imam now still?
Exactly. That's a very good question.
Didn't Imam show a successful way of being able to maintain your religion?
Sure.
And
the other thing I wanted to raise, Dr. Mahdi Tarabi, was...
And your maintain your servitude to God and to maintain your yeah. allegiance to the Prophet, peace be upon him, without having to become a servant, without having to become a crazy...
A slave.
You know, lunatic.
Yeah, a lunatic, a slave and a lunatic.
Organ eater.
Yeah.
I mean, isn't that
yeah.
good? Isn't
yeah.
that a way to go? Isn't that maybe an option you should start considering?
Well, I must admit and I must confess, Dr. Mahdi Tarabi, that Imam Khomeini, may God bless his soul, you know, he began the whole process of Unity Week. You know, he came up with this Unity Week, this conference by which we could all come together on the birthday of the Holy Prophet. Doesn't matter about the differences of what we understand
well,
historically.
I mean,
that was the genius of the whole
instead
thing.
Of,
that's
instead
the
of
thing
turning
I,
it into a mm. into a point of contention,
yeah.
he said, okay, one rivayat, one hadith is this day, the other one is the other one. So
yeah.
we'll have the whole week.
We'll have the whole week to celebrate the Holy Prophet.
We'll
birthday.
Celebrate the whole week. You know,
why not?
It's a week apart or
why
whatever,
not?
A couple
we,
days
we,
apart.
We get 2 weeks for Christmas, don't we?
Right. So
yeah.
then you have what's day, you know, which is the final
yes.
Friday of Ramadan.
That's right,
you know?
Yes.
I mean, excuse me, are the Palestinians Shia? Is that the reason why we support
no,
them?
No, no, I don't think they are, as far as
right.
I remember.
I mean, who supported the Palestinians more than Imam and his movement? And
that's
Islam
right.
Which,
that's
which
right.
country? Who's paid more for this stance in the international era than Iran?
Absolutely.
So why are you still stuck with this? Why are you still following people like Al-Saud and these, you know, ignorant people who claim to follow Islam, but they're just servants of the non-Muslims? When are you going to wake up? When are you going to finally get it? Look at what happened to Morsi. Where is Morsi today? The first democratically civilian elected president of Egypt.
That's right.
Just think about that.
Yeah.
Why? Because instead of going and becoming close with those people who were supporting you for 40 years,
mm.
when everybody else, when, you know, you remember at the beginning in the 80s,
yes.
who was supporting Ikhwan in Egypt when they were all being sent to prison and being executed?
It was Iran.
Right.
It was the Islamic
okay.
Revolution.
Right. And so what happens? So instead of going and, you know, sticking with the one that's proven itself to be the real deal.
The real deal, McCoy, that's right, yes.
The real McCoy.
The
right?
real McCoy, the voice
you
of
go,
the voiceless.
You go, you know, mm. trying to satisfy the Saudis and, you know, talk, mm. calling